A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this story from a cafe in Jerusalem. He's watching a guy in a wheelchair struggle to get up. Someone helps him. They start talking. And then the helper, a man without a kippah, visibly secular, places his hand on the stranger's head and launches into a braca. Right there, between the espresso machine and the pastry case. And Daniel's question is basically, where does this gesture actually come from? The hand on the head during a blessing. Because it shows up in the Friday night blessing of children. It shows up in the priestly blessing with the Kohanim. And even the word for rabbinic ordination, smicha, literally means laying on. He's also noticing this same gesture pops up across cultures and religions. And he's asking what's going on there.
That cafe moment is remarkable because it collapses about 3,000 years of embodied tradition into a spontaneous act between strangers. The man didn't need institutional authorization. He didn't need a title. He just knew the words and knew where his hand goes. And that gesture, the palm on the crown of someone's head while speaking a blessing, it's one of the oldest continuous ritual actions in Jewish practice. We can trace it to a specific verse, Genesis 48:14, where Jacob blesses his grandsons Ephraim and Manasseh. That's the prototype. Everything flows from there.
Daniel's right that this isn't just a Jewish thing. You see it in Christian confirmation, in Hindu darshan, in Buddhist empowerment rituals. The hand on the head keeps showing up, which suggests something deeper than theology. Something about what it means to be human and to want to transmit something intangible through the most direct physical channel available.
The head as the seat of consciousness, or the soul, depending on your framework. But either way, if you're going to transfer something spiritual, blessing, authority, healing, where else would you put your hand? It's the most intimate, vulnerable, authoritative point of contact you can make with another person without being invasive. And the fact that this gesture survives across completely different religious systems suggests it's tapping into something pre-doctrinal, something about bodies before beliefs.
We've got three distinct threads in Jewish tradition that all use the hands differently, but share this root idea. The Friday night blessing, where parents place both hands on their child's head. The priestly blessing where the Kohanim raise their hands toward the congregation with fingers split into that distinctive pattern. And smicha, where a rabbi presses hands on a student's head to transmit authority. Three different mechanics, same underlying grammar.
The question Daniel's really asking, I think, is what makes this grammar work? Why does a hand on a head carry so much weight? Is it blessing? Is it authority? Is it something else entirely? The answer, I'd argue, is that it's all of those things simultaneously, and the gesture collapses the distinction. When you place your hand on someone's head and speak a blessing, you're claiming a kind of authority, but it's the authority to bless, not to command. It's power channeled toward the other person's good. That's a very specific thing. That specific thing, authority channeled for another's good, it's baked into the very structure of how these three contexts work. The Friday night blessing is the most intimate. Parents place both hands directly on the child's head. It's the domestic version of what Jacob did with Ephraim and Manasseh. You're claiming this child is yours to bless, and you're invoking the same words the Kohanim use in the temple.
Which is a fascinating democratization when you think about it. The priestly blessing was originally the exclusive domain of Aaron's descendants, a hereditary caste performing a highly choreographed ritual. And now it's the thing you do at the dinner table with your kids, chicken soup going cold in the background.
And the priestly blessing itself. Birkat Kohanim operates differently. The Kohanim don't touch anyone. They raise their hands to shoulder height, fingers spread in that distinctive pattern, palms facing the congregation. It's communal transmission rather than individual contact. You're blessing the entire assembly at once, and the hands function more like an antenna array than a point of contact. The Talmud in Sota 38a is very specific about this. The Kohen must raise his hands, must spread his fingers, must face the people. The physical form matters as much as the words.
Then Smica takes it in yet another direction. Here the hands are pressed on the head of a single individual, but the purpose isn't blessing, it's transmission of authority. Moses lays hands on Joshua in Numbers 27, and suddenly Joshua has what Moses had. The gesture creates a chain. One pair of hands to the next head, generation after generation.
Which is why the disruption of that chain in the 4th century is so significant. Once the physical contact stops, something is lost that can't be recovered through text alone. The gesture is the credential. Without it, you're studying the same material, but you're not receiving the same transmission.
Daniel's Cafe Moment sits at this interesting intersection. It's not the priestly blessing. It's one-on-one. It's not smicker. No authority is being transferred. It's closest to the Friday night blessing, but between strangers. And the man didn't need a kippah to do it. He just needed to know that his hand belonged on that man's head, and that the words belonged in his mouth.
Which is really the through line here. All three forms assume that something real passes through physical contact, or physical proximity, in the case of Birkat Kohanim, that can't be transmitted any other way. The hand isn't a symbol. It's a conduit.
Let's dig into that prototype then. Genesis 48:14. Jacob is old, his eyes are dim with age, and Joseph brings his two sons to receive the blessing. Joseph positions Manasseh, the firstborn, at Jacob's right hand, the place of primacy. And Jacob deliberately crosses his hands. He puts his right hand on Ephraim's head, and his left on Manasseh's. Joseph tries to correct him, and Jacob says no. I know what I'm doing.
The crossed hands are everything here. In the ancient Near East, the right hand wasn't just the dominant hand, it was the hand of power, of oath-taking, of favor. When you blessed someone with your right hand, you were conferring legitimacy. The firstborn gets the right hand. That's the natural order. And Jacob says, essentially, the natural order isn't the final word. God chooses whom God chooses. The younger over the elder, it's the same pattern as Jacob himself over Esau, as Isaac over Ishmael.
The gesture isn't just a delivery mechanism for words. The gesture is making a theological argument. The crossing of the hand says, this blessing doesn't follow the rules you expect. It's not automatic. It's not inheritance law. It's something else.
That's why the physical contact matters so much in this moment. Jacob doesn't just speak the blessing across the room. He places his hands on their heads. The touch is the transmission. Genesis 48 is the first time in Scripture that a blessing is conferred through hand-to-head contact, and it sets the template for everything that follows. The hand becomes the instrument of channeling something from one person to another, something that words alone can't carry.
Which brings us to the Friday night table. Because the blessing Jewish parents give their children, it's a direct descendant of this moment. You place both hands on the child's head, and you recite the priestly blessing from Numbers 6. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. May the Lord lift his countenance upon you and grant you peace. For boys, some add the blessing to be like Ephraim and Manasseh. For girls, like Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah.
What's striking is that this isn't a rabbinic obligation. It's a minhag, a custom that developed organically. The sources in my Jewish learning trace it back to the 17th century in some communities, but the impulse is clearly older. Parents wanted to be Jacob. They wanted to place their hands on their children's heads and transmit something. Protection, identity, connection to the chain. The gesture democratizes what was once a patriarchal prerogative. Every parent becomes a conduit.
There's also something deeply practical about it. Kids don't always listen to words. They're distracted. They're fidgeting. The challah smells good, but touch cuts through. The hand on the head says, stop. This moment is different. Something is happening to you right now. It's a physical anchor for attention.
That's where the priestly blessing diverges in a really interesting way. Because the Kohanim don't touch anyone, they raise their hands toward the congregation, fingers split into that distinctive pattern. The thumb and index finger separated from the middle and ring fingers, creating a shape that's said to resemble the Hebrew letter Shin, for Shaddai, one of the divine names. The Talmud in Megillah 23b and Sota 38a is meticulous about this. Hands at shoulder height. The Kohen faces the people, not the ark.
Why no contact there? Why the shift from Jacob's direct touch to this raised hand no contact mode?
Part of it is practical. You can't physically touch an entire congregation. But I think the deeper reason is about the nature of the blessing itself. The priestly blessing is channeled through the Kohanim, not generated by them. The liturgy makes this explicit. The Kohen recites a blessing before the blessing, acknowledging that God commanded them to bless the people. The hands aren't transmitting the Kohen's own authority. They're functioning as an aperture. The Kohen is a window, not a source.
Which is a very different model from the parent blessing a child. The parent's hands on the child's head are personal. This is me, your father, your mother, blessing you. The love and the authority are intertwined. The Kohen's raised hands are impersonal in the best sense. They're transparent to the source. Look past me. I'm just the conduit.
Yet both forms rely on the same underlying assumption, that the hands matter. They're not optional. You can't just say the words. The physical form is part of the ritual's efficacy. The Talmud goes so far as to say that a Kohen who doesn't raise his hands properly shouldn't participate in the blessing. The gesture isn't decorative. It's constitutive.
We've got this spectrum. On one end, the intimate touch of a parent on a child's head. Full contact, personal authority, love, and blessing fused. On the other end, the Kohen's raised hands, no contact, communal transmission, transparency to divine source. And in the middle, Jacob's crossed hands, contact, but deliberately subverting the expected order. Three different hand positions, three different statements about what blessing is and how it flows.
The right hand keeps showing up as the primary instrument across all three. Jacob insists on placing his right hand on Ephraim despite Joseph's protest. The Kohen raises both hands, but the right side is traditionally given precedence in the liturgy. The preference for the right hand in blessing isn't arbitrary. It's rooted in that ancient Near Eastern symbolism of power and favor. But Jacob's crossing shows that the right hand's power isn't mechanical. It's not magic. It's subject to divine will. The hand is the instrument, not the source. Now there's a parallel track we haven't touched yet, and it's the one Daniel flagged with the word smicha. The term literally means leaning or laying on. And it comes from a different biblical moment than Jacob's blessing, Numbers 27, where God tells Moses to take Joshua and lay his hand upon him before the entire congregation. Moses uses both hands, actually, according to the Midrash. One hand isn't enough when you're transferring the full weight of leadership.
This isn't blessing in the sense of may God protect you. This is, you now carry what I carry.
And the physical form reflects that. In classical smicha, the ordaining rabbi would press both hands firmly on the candidate's head. Not a gentle placement like the Friday night blessing. The gesture says, I am loading something onto you. Authority, responsibility, the chain itself. The Hebrew term for the transmission chain is mazora, and smicha is the mechanism that links each generation to the next. Moses to Joshua, Joshua to the elders to the prophets to the men of the great assembly. In theory, an unbroken line of hands on heads stretching back to Sinai. Because here's where it gets historically complicated. In the 4th century, the Roman Empire under Hadrian, or more precisely, in the aftermath of the Bar Kokhba revolt, made smicha a capital offense. The Romans understood exactly what the gesture meant. It wasn't just a ceremony. It was the creation of Jewish legal authority outside Roman control, so they banned it. Ordaining a rabbi or being ordained could get you executed. According to tradition, one sage, Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, took 5 students out to a place between 2 mountains, away from Roman eyes, and ordained them before being killed by soldiers. He died so the chain wouldn't break.
Did it work?
It bought time, but the chain didn't survive intact. The exact line of transmission from Moses was severed. What we have today, when a rabbi gets smicha from the chief rabbinate or from a yeshiva, that's technically not smicha in the original sense. It's a different certification called Yore Yore, which means, may he teach, may he decide. It authorizes a rabbi to rule on matters of Jewish law, but it doesn't claim to be the unbroken chain from Moses.
The gesture lost its original meaning because the physical transmission was interrupted. Once the hands stop touching heads for a generation or two, you can't just restart it. The chain is only as strong as its weakest link, and a broken link means the whole thing becomes something else.
Maimonides tried to revive it in the 12th century. He argued that if all the sages in the land of Israel agreed, they could re-establish the original smicha and restart the chain. He actually got some traction in Safed in the 16th century. Rabbi Yaakov Bairav attempted a revival, ordained a few scholars, including Rabbi Yosef Karo, who wrote the Shulchan Aruch. But the Jerusalem rabbinate opposed it, and the experiment collapsed. No one since has seriously attempted to restore the Mosaic chain.
Which tells us something about the fragility of embodied tradition. You can preserve the text perfectly. And Judaism did, obsessively. Every word of the Talmud, every legal ruling, every commentary. But the gesture? The weight of a hand on a head? That's harder to archive. Once it stops happening, you lose something that can't be reconstructed from manuscripts.
Yet, and this is the paradox, the gesture keeps reappearing. Not the smicha chain itself, but the impulse to place a hand on someone's head and transmit something. It survived the loss of the original institution. It migrated into the domestic sphere with the Friday night blessing. It showed up in that Jerusalem cafe with a man who probably couldn't tell you the difference between yore yore and classical smicha, but knew exactly where his hand belonged.
Which brings us to Daniel's other observation. This isn't just a Jewish thing. The same gesture appears in Christian practice. The laying on of hands for confirmation, for ordination, for healing. The bishop places hands on the confirmant's head to confer the Holy Spirit. In Hindu darshan, a devotee touches the feet of a guru and receives a blessing on the head in return. In Tibetan Buddhist empowerment rituals, the lama touches the crown of the disciple's head to transmit the lineage blessing. Different theologies, identical physical form.
That recurrence across completely unrelated traditions suggests something anthropological rather than theological. The head is universally understood as the seat of the person. Consciousness, soul, selfhood. Whatever word you use, that's where we locate it. Touching someone's head is the most direct possible address to who they are. It's intimate in a way that touching a hand or a shoulder isn't. It's also inherently vulnerable for both parties. The person receiving the touch has to trust you, and the person giving it is making themselves responsible for what they transmit.
There's also a vertical dimension. The head is the highest point of the body. The hand comes down onto it. The gesture physically enacts a relationship. Something flows downward, from a source to a recipient. You don't bless someone by touching their knee. The head makes the hierarchy visible, even when the hierarchy is temporary and loving, like a parent to a child.
That's where the cafe moment becomes so powerful, because the man in the wheelchair didn't know his blesser. There was no established relationship, no institutional framework, no kippah signaling religious authority. Just one person recognizing another person's suffering and reaching for the most ancient human gesture of transmission. His hand knew what to do before his brain had time to theologize about it.
It's pre-doctrinal, like you said. The gesture predates the explanations. Jacob didn't have a theological treatise on why the right hand matters. He just crossed his hands and did it, and the meaning emerged from the act. Moses didn't deliver a lecture on the theory of transmission. He pressed his hands on Joshua, and the thing was done. The cafe blessing is the same impulse, stripped of all institutional scaffolding. A hand, a head, and words of blessing. That's the irreducible core. Which is really the practical question Daniel's asking, even if he didn't phrase it that way. How do you take this and actually do it? The Friday night blessing is the obvious entry point. It requires no ordination, no special status, no kippah. Just a hand and the words.
The words are right there in number 6. You can say them in Hebrew or English or whatever language your kid actually understands. The gesture doesn't care about your accent. What matters is that you place your hand on their head and mean it. That's the whole ritual. Everything else, the candles, the challah, the wine, that's scaffolding. The hand on the head is the load-bearing wall.
There's also something worth naming for people who didn't grow up with this. The first time you do it, it feels a little strange. You're touching your kid's head and speaking formal words, and part of your brain is going, "Is this weird? Am I doing this right?" And the answer is yes, it's a little weird, and no, you're not doing it wrong, because the weirdness is part of what makes it land. The kid notices that something different is happening. That's the point.
I saw this as a pediatrician, actually. Not the blessing specifically, but the way physical touch from a parent changes a child's state. Heart rate drops. There's a physiological response to a hand on the head that's separate from whatever words you're saying. The blessing piggybacks on that. You're not inventing a new channel. You're using one that's already there, hardwired.
Which is why the cafe moment worked. The man in the wheelchair didn't need to be told what was happening. His body already understood the grammar. A hand on the head means you are seen, you matter. Something is being given to you. The words just specify what that something is.
For secular or non-observant Jews, or honestly, anyone, this is about as low barrier as ritual gets. You don't need synagogue membership. You don't need Hebrew literacy. You don't need to believe anything in particular about God. The gesture itself carries the weight. If all you can manage is placing a hand on your child's head and saying, "May you be safe, may you be happy, may you know you are loved, congratulations, you just joined a 3,000-year-old tradition."
The man in the cafe didn't check the guy's denominational affiliation. He didn't ask if he was Orthodox or secular or anything in between. He saw a person in pain and reached for the most direct transmission of care his tradition gave him. That's the thing about embodied ritual. It bypasses the theological committee in your head and goes straight to the hand.
That's really the takeaway from everything we've traced. The hand on the head persists because it works. It survived the loss of the original smica chain. It survived the destruction of the temple. It survived secularization and assimilation, and everything the modern world throws at tradition. And here it is, in a Jerusalem cafe, between two men who just met, no kippah in sight. The gesture doesn't need institutions. It needs people willing to reach out and bless.
If you're listening and you've never done this, this Friday night, before the meal, put your hand on your kid's head, or your partner's head, or just someone who could use a blessing. Say the words if you know them. Say your own if you don't. The hand does the work. It's been doing the work since Jacob crossed his hands over two bewildered boys in Egypt and changed what blessing could mean. It makes me wonder about the polarization we're living with. Orthodox and secular Jews increasingly occupying different worlds, different neighborhoods, different schools, different media. And yet, here's this gesture that neither side owns. The secular guy in the cafe knew the bracha. The Orthodox father at his Shabbat table is doing the same hand-on-head motion. It's the same grammar. The question is whether embodied rituals like this can bridge a divide that ideology keeps widening.
The cafe suggests they can, but not through argument. Nobody was convinced of anything. There was no debate about denominational boundaries, just a hand on a head and words that both men recognized as belonging to them. That's the thing about physical ritual. It operates beneath the level of disagreement. You don't have to agree on theology to agree that a blessing is appropriate when someone is suffering.
In an age where so much connection is mediated by screens, I think these touch-based rituals are going to become more precious, not less. You can't zoom a hand on the head. You can't text a blessing and get the same thing. The physical contact is the whole point. It's irreplaceable in the most literal sense. There is no digital substitute for weight and warmth.
The hand on the head is defiantly analog. It requires proximity. It requires presence. In a world that's racing to dematerialize everything, this gesture insists that bodies still matter. That something real passes between people when they touch that can't be compressed into data.
Here's our ask. If this episode resonated, if you've ever received a blessing this way, or given one, or witnessed something like what Daniel saw in that cafe, we'd love to hear about it. Send us your story. Show at myweirdprompts.com.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
The 1902 coronation of King Carlos I of Portugal included a ceremonial anointing with chrism oil, whose chemical composition was specified to contain exactly 12% myrrh resin, a formula originally documented by a Portuguese missionary observing Cape Verdean herbal traditions in the 1870s.
12% myrrh.
I have so many questions, and I'm going to ask none of them.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want more episodes, find us at myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
Until then, may someone place a hand on your head and mean it.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go from sloth slow takes to facts untrue. we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's new, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.